This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. More than 12,000 patients in Connecticut are registered for the state's medical marijuana program. That's according to the Department of Consumer Protection. In just a bit, we'll hear from DCP Commissioner Jonathan Harris about how the program has been running over the last 2.5 years. To date, more than half of U.S. states allow medical marijuana. We'll check in with medical professionals and dispensaries here in Connecticut that provide marijuana to patients with certain conditions. And later in the hour, we'll hear about research that explores whether cannabis could decrease the use of opioid painkillers. Could marijuana put a dent in the opioid overdose epidemic in this country? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. But first, we're going to start with a personal story. Again, Connecticut's law only allows residents with certain medical conditions to participate in the medical marijuana program. Tracy Helene was one of those residents. His wife, Christy Covell, joins us today. Thank you so much for coming in, Christy.
Thank you for having me, Lucy.
So full disclosure, I was friends with both you and Tracy as a Middletown resident. And my condolences to you because Tracy recently passed away.
Yes, thank you.
I read his obituary, and it read that he won a 10-year battle with cancer by walking away August 15th.
Yes, exactly. And that's exactly how he wanted to phrase it, too. He didn't like the term passed away. He phrased it, and he wrote his own obituary, and he was a strong and powerful man.
For people that know you, you have many friends that love both of you, and you were very, very open about his journey the last 10 years battling this cancer. Tell our listeners about him.
So he was a wonderful man. We celebrated our 20-year anniversary in May, but for 10 years of our marriage, he had cancer. He was diagnosed in 2006 with a rare testicular cancer, and at the time, we had gotten a couple of options, and he had it removed, and we decided to wait and see because they determined that drugs wouldn't be effective. He had a couple of years where it was, you know, in remission, and in 2011 had a radical surgery, the RP-LND surgery, which is a radical lymph node dissection surgery. He had a couple more years being free and clear, and then in 2014 had the surgery again, and then had another surgery in 2015. Subsequently, then he tried a chemo, which we were told at the time just had a small chance of working. And it was very, very minimally effective. And then he went on a clinical trial last fall for a very brief period of time, but he went off of it because the side effects were too detrimental. And so he decided at that point to get on the state's medical marijuana program because he had read that cannabis oil in particular could be helpful for cancer. And at that point, we were sort of out of options, and his physicians were supportive of him trying that option.
So talk about that process. So he made the decision at that point to try medical marijuana. How easy is it to get that information, to find? Obviously, you need to have a certain condition. So can you walk us through the process that Tracy uncovered when we decided to do this?
So for him, he had stopped working back in May of 2015. So he did a little bit of research, and he found a physician, his local oncologist. So in full disclosure, he has a local oncologist in Middletown, and then he was being followed by Dana-Farber physicians as his primary. And so he found a local physician in Connecticut, and he brought his records to that physician and had an exam. And the physician was participating in the state's medical program. And then he went and utilized the dispensary in Hartford on Weston Street. From the beginning, he found the program extremely user-friendly. The products are available online, both in terms of leaves and oils. And he was really primarily interested in obtaining the oil. He had read a lot online about THC oil being helpful for cancer. So he was purchasing, the pre-filled syringes of cannabis oil. And for people that don't know cannabis oil, it's thick. It's not like a vegetable oil. It's sort of like molasses. And he would make brownies with it, and he would have a brownie every night, and he did this for a period of time in the fall, all the way till about June. And not only did he have success with it, he had some reduction in his tumors, but also some stability. And we both believe that it gave him quality of life, for the majority of this year, which I don't think he would have otherwise had.
So at last November, there were no other chemo treatments or clinical trials to try. If he hadn't started the medical marijuana program, there wouldn't have been anything else for him?
No, there wasn't. There was one other drug called Opdivo, which, you know, is advertised. But it was one of those drugs that there was nothing with his type of cancer shown to be at all effective. And the doctor said, you know, you're better off. We're waiting to wait and try that because Opdivo, you know, they advertised maybe they'll give you a few more months. And so he opted to try the cannabis oil route instead.
And you mentioned he saw some shrinkage of his tumors. Had that ever happened before?
You know, they had not. You know, again, what he had was so rare. There's very little research on what he had. You know, his tumor, when it was initially operated, was sent out to Indiana. And there's very little research on the type of testicular cancer he had. It mirrored an ovarian cancer in a woman. So the average life expectancy, and it was with much older men, was 5 to 7 years. So they hadn't seen this and they were surprised, but they were supportive. And they basically just told him at that point, just keep doing what you're doing. So when he was scanned in February, there was some reduction and then stability in his scans in March and then in May as well.
As I mentioned earlier, Commissioner Jonathan Harris is in studio with us. He's the commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Consumer Protection. Thanks for coming on today.
Lucy, thanks for having me. It's great to be on with my friend Christy, and a great woman, great advocate, and Tracy also someone that we'll miss but lives on.
Tell us about how the program's been running.
Program's been very successful. It's been maturing and growing no matter how you slice it. Just take the numbers. When the medicine first came online 2 years ago in September of 2014, there were 1,681 patients or so. As of this morning, the count that I just got, which we can get in real time, there were 12,554 patients, so big growth. When you talk about the doctors, the physicians that were certifying people that had these really serious diseases, there were 81 physicians in September of 2014. Today, the count this morning, 518 physicians, so it's growing in that way. The numbers of products, the innovation on the ground, the types of medicine, only about 30% or so is the flower that people think about when they think of marijuana. There are all products from tinctures, you know, oils, topicals, edibles, as Christy said. There are sublingual strips, pills, and each do different things with different mixes of chemicals. It's not just about THC, and it's not just about getting high that, you know, people understandably don't know about the program. But as you can see from the numbers that they're learning, when you talk about results, the anecdotal results of shrinkage of tumors, people having better health care, it's really successful. And we can even talk about some of the jobs created and things at some point. But what I guess the bottom line is that the program is successfully maturing no matter how you look at it, providing good health care and providing another option to really, really sick patients with their physicians and their pharmacists to help them.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking about the state's medical marijuana program. It's been running now for over two years. And if you have a call or a question or a comment, you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. I want to bring Derek into the conversation. Derek, you're on Where We Live. Derek, can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm here.
And you're from West Hartford. Tell us about...
Yeah, I'm from West Hartford. Mm-hmm. So I just thought I'd call in because I was on an opiate program for actually a chronic pain condition called testicular orchialgia. And it was very easy for me to get opiates. And I decided to search alternative pain care and care for my other mental illnesses, which qualify me in Connecticut for medical marijuana. And I have to say that I've found a lot of relief through CBD products and THC products. And it's a great program, and I'm really happy it's coming to the state. And like the gentleman was just saying, there's sublingual strips, there's oils, there's all kinds of stuff. And I think that it's just a really great resource to have. And I think as somebody who's seen opiate offices, pain management offices full of clients, that we should be getting a lot of these patients into marijuana dispensaries so they can get off these opiates. Because as we all know, that Connecticut is kind of plagued by opiate addiction, created by these doctors who just kind of push opiates on people. So, you know, it's just been very successful for me, and I wish it was readily available to people with chronic pain problems, and hopefully it will be soon.
Thank you, Derek, for your call, and please stay with us throughout the show. We're actually going to be talking to a researcher about the research being done, whether cannabis is helping people with chronic pain get off opiate painkillers. It's going to be later in the hour. When Christy Covell is here, again, her husband passed away recently. He used medical marijuana for the last year after battling cancer for a long time. What side effects did he have, if at all?
So, he had pain pills prescribed to him, over the years, and he didn't really care for those. I'm just sort of echoing, just the sentiments of the caller. But the side effects for marijuana are actually minimal. So he had, fatigue, and he would sleep a lot. So he'd sleep maybe 10 hours a night, but he was utilizing the medicine at night. Or maybe he'd have dry mouth during the day. But those are the only two side effects. When he had surgeries, he had pain pills, and he really went off of those quickly because he found that there were much more side effects. So he found the side effects to be very minimal.
Before we head to break, I wanted to go back to Commissioner Harris. We heard Derek saying that, he suffers from chronic pain. He hopes that more people with chronic pain could be able to be eligible for the medical marijuana program. Can you talk through us again about which patients are able to be to get into the program and any expansion in the future?
Yeah, when the law passed, there were 11 debilitating conditions: cancer, HIV, AIDS, multiple sclerosis, some really serious conditions. And there have been, since that time, 6 added. So now we have 17. There will be an additional 5 added for the adults. And then minors, actually, as of October 1, will have access for 6 really serious conditions, severe epilepsy, cystic fibrosis. So there will be additional and some much stricter, but access for minors. So as of October 1, you'll have 23 debilitating conditions for adults and 6 for minors. There is a way through our website. You can go to ct.gov.dcp, and you can actually go onto the medical marijuana program page, and there's a petition. If somebody would like to add a condition, we have a process that has the Board of Physicians having a public hearing, making a recommendation to me whether to add that. Then it goes through the whole regulatory process where there will be another public hearing, public comment. But there are ways to do it, or they can go to their legislator and talk about changing the law to add that condition.
Today, where we live, we're getting an update on Connecticut's medical marijuana program. In studio is Christy Covell, whose late husband, Tracy Helene, participated in the program during his battle with cancer. Also, Commissioner of the State Department of Consumer Protection, Jonathan Harris, is here with us. The agency oversees the program, the Department of Consumer Protection. When we come back, we'll learn more about the process and whether Connecticut's program will expand. Well, again, we heard a little bit. We'll hear more. Also, we'll explore whether Connecticut is likely to legalize the recreational use of marijuana in the near future. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Connecticut's medical marijuana program has been up and running for more than 2 years, meaning patients with certain medical conditions can obtain marijuana from 6 dispensaries in the state. That doesn't sound like many, and we're going to find out more about how patients actually obtain the marijuana. We'll find out more from a dispensary owner in the state as well as a doctor. But first, I wanted to go back to our in-studio guest. Christy Covell is here again, a Middletown resident. She was her husband's caregiver for a long time, Tracy Helene, who recently passed away after a 10-year battle with cancer. Can we talk about cost?
We can. The cost for this program for us was several hundred dollars a month. The oil itself is very, very expensive. And because Tracy was, sort of taking the amounts that he would read online in terms of how much it would be effective, it was anywhere between $200 to $400 or $500 a month for him to be on this program, which we were paying out of pocket. Again, it was by choice, and because it was effective, we were opting to continue that. But it was something, worth noting.
That's interesting, Commissioner Harris. When people hear about medical programs, they might think, oh, well, if I have a condition, I'm able to get a drug to help me, but this is not covered by insurance.
It is not required under Connecticut law to be covered by insurance. And remember, when this started back in 2012, this was a new animal. I mean, this was on the cutting edge. We are the first state to have this pharmaceutical model, a very highly regulated model. And even with that, there was a lot of stigma, misunderstanding. So you had to start things in a way that was limited, that you could grow, that you could build understanding with people, expansion of the market, of products, of participants from the medical side, from the patient side. And so require, you know, if insurance was required, or even not sending the signal to an insurance company that it would not be required, that could have added more opposition to the bill. I think at some point, not only will the market expand, we actually now have eight dispensaries because two were added, and there will be a ninth in the fall, though Angelo could tell you because that's his second one successfully in there. And the market, because this is a free market regulated product just like any other pharmaceutical, the market will start helping to deal with the prices, and they will be going, you know, I think there'll be some pressure to move some of those down.
What are we seeing in other states?
Oh, well, also, and I think insurance companies are going to start realizing that it will be actually financially beneficial for them to cover this medicine, especially as it compares to some opioids, other painkillers, other medicines that are out there. So we're hearing from other states similar kinds of things. But again, we have a very unique program. People have tried to and are, in fact, kind of adopting ours. But we are out there on the cutting edge. So we're doing what we need to do.
Well, you're referring to Angelo DeFazio, owner and founder of Aero Alternative Care and president and CEO of Aero Pharmacy. Welcome to Where We Live, Angelo.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Commissioner Harris said that this program is unique compared to other states. Talk about that. How is it?
Incredibly unique. First of all, Christy, our deepest condolences for Tracy. He'll be sorely missed at the dispensary.
Thank you.
From all the pharmacists and the crew, our deepest condolences. Good morning, Mr. Commissioner.
Good morning.
So what makes us so interesting and rewarding professionally as a pharmacist is our system did not change what I like to call the 3P paradigm in our distribution system, the physician, the pharmacist, and the patient. That triangle, that paradigm is imperative for positive clinical outcomes. And because of the face-to-face that we get to meet and consult with these patients and meet with them for long periods of time, sometimes over an hour, sometimes a couple hours with certain patients with complex diseases, that helps shape the dosage forms, the products that we help pick, working with their physicians and their caregivers to come up with a comprehensive plan that we get to see them face-to-face, weekly, monthly, depending on the amount that they can purchase, and keep track of these clinical outcomes. And that's what makes our system so well and the gatekeeping that takes place in Connecticut and how we slowly adopted and the transparency that goes on between the state, the patient, the physician, and the dispensary is so, so important in this program. And you can see how well it's grown. And it's so positive as a pharmacist to see these patients have these remarkable outcomes at times, and you sit there and you go, wow, this is why I spent all those years studying for the pharmacology that I do.
So you have a dispensary in Hartford?
I do.
And what have you seen in terms of the amount of patients coming to your dispensary? What are their conditions?
The conditions are the gamut. You know, post-traumatic is probably the number one disease state. Cancer follows closely because of our affinity to two major hospitals. We see the gamut of disease states at our facility. We have eight registered pharmacies at our facility, and typically three or four are on at the same time to be able to handle all these disease states and do the consultations that we need to do. Full medical, we do MTM services, medical therapy, medication reviews, so we know what prescriptions they're taking ahead of time, so we can talk about some of the side effects and whether or not they'll be potentiated by the medicine that they're taking. But one of the greatest feelings I have is how we've been able to actually, speaking of opiates, take patients off of opiates. And what makes Connecticut unique, and this is really important, is that all our medical marijuana goes into the prescription monitoring program the same way all narcotics do from every pharmacy. So any healthcare provider that has access to the PMP program, the prescription monitoring program, can see whether or not the patient is taking medical marijuana. And we can also see their opiates decrease and be eliminated because we know if they're getting them filled or not. So that's not anecdotal. That's a fact because we can see whether or not the prescriptions are being filled. And it's amazing how many patients we've been able to taper off under pharmacist and physician guidance to zero opiates, and now they're controlling their pain or their symptoms of their disease state just with medical marijuana.
You mentioned gatekeeping earlier. So this program, the way Connecticut has it set up, it's very hard to abuse the system?
I believe it is. And what makes our system unique, we have a healthcare provider at the point of service, and that's very important. Pharmacists have been handling narcotics and that point of service with a patient for decades. And our distribution system in this country works because of the healthcare provider at every single point of service. And I think that that's added to the safety, the public safety, the quality of the whole program because we have a healthcare provider at every point.
Speaking of healthcare providers, we have Dr. Andrew Solner joining us. He's the director of the Hartford Healthcare Cancer Institute at Hartford Hospital. Dr. Solner, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
Tell us what you have seen with your patients.
I've also been very enthusiastic about the program. I've been engaged since the beginning and increasingly have seen patients who have really benefited from the use of medical cannabis. I certify cancer patients because I'm a cancer physician, and we've used medical cannabis in treating patients with chronic pain syndromes, nausea, poor appetite, seizure issues, sleep disturbances. All of those really can benefit from the use of medical cannabis. And as Angela was saying, it really is a partnership with the pharmacist because as a physician, my role in the program is to certify the patient into the program. And in doing so, basically, I make sure that the patient qualifies for the program, that they have one of the disabling conditions that's listed in the state law. And at the same time, I discuss with them the pros and cons of using medical cannabis and determine that the benefits of participating in the program would outweigh the risks. That's when I certify them into the program. It's different from the usual model where we have an FDA-approved drug and a physician actually prescribes the dose and format of the medication. This is not an FDA-approved drug, as everyone knows. It's medical cannabis, and therefore the dispensing pharmacist is actually the one who sits down with the patient, talks about the different formulations, whether it's smoked, whether it's taken by mouth, whether it's inhaled as a vapor, whether it's placed under the tongue, whether it's a baked good that they take, whether it has CBD, which is one of the two major cannabinoids in the drug that is generally beneficial for the medical purposes of medical marijuana. So it's a great partnership, as Angela was saying, between the physician and the pharmacist in terms of getting feedback from the patient and continuing to tweak that dose and formulation until we reach something that really works for the patient.
Before we take another call, Dr. Solner, I just was curious, you know, how have you seen doctors' perception of marijuana change over the last few years? Because, I've heard from some doctors, you know, who really do believe marijuana is a gateway drug. So can you talk about, is that perception changing? What are you seeing among your peers?
It's gradually and slowly changing because, you know, the education about new drugs is usually done because a new drug is approved and physicians can get education through their specialty society or through articles in journals and in the literature. This is a little bit different, and I think physicians have been wary about it, number one, because there's a stigma associated with marijuana, and number two, because it is a Schedule I with the federal government, which means that physicians have had some anxiety about prosecution if they're involved in the program. And I think there is a misconception that it's addictive and it's a gateway drug. Actually, the studies really show that it's much less addictive than many of the opioids and other medications we prescribe routinely. It has a lower side effect profile than many of the drugs we prescribe routinely. And interestingly enough, I've also seen many of our patients be able to get off some of the drugs that they've been on. And one of the reasons that I use the program and recommend it to patients is because they have so many side effects from their conventional meds that they may actually tolerate medical cannabis better, and it may accomplish the same or more for them.
We're getting a Facebook comment from Jonathan. He wrote, "On Monday night, I had a panic attack, and I couldn't function until I smoked. I rarely smoke, and I prefer not to. I don't understand why it's not entirely decriminalized yet. It's 2016. I think that's a thought that many people have. Because we've had this program for some time, we're seeing more and more states authorizing medical marijuana Could Connecticut legalize marijuana for recreational use? You used to be a lawmaker, Commissioner Harris. What are your thoughts on that?
They definitely could, and that's what the policymakers have to determine. But I think that people have to separate the medical program from a retail program if that happens. This is much different. I mean, we have these four producers that are growing in secure indoor facilities, the plants, and then through science, like you'd see in any other drug manufacturing company, any other high-tech manufacturing company, separating out the different parts of it and making different types of medicine. And to emphasize and pick up what Dr. Salner said, you know, with the CBDs, the cannabinoid, a lot of this is not getting people high in the way that they think, that addictive, even if it's psychological addiction. It is providing relief through different types of receptors within the body. This is science. And when you have the medical program, you have to meet certain health, safety, security, and other requirements. You can't have any pesticides that are put on the plants when they're grown. The FDA standards, we have the food inspectors, and if you do have, I think, three of the four manufacturers of the producers have kitchens to make edibles, they have those edibles inspected like we inspect food. There's homogenization of product. It has to be lab tested and labeled and put into secure capsules, secure packaging so that kids can't get at it. And you know, when you look at that label, exactly what's in there, active ingredients, inactive ingredients, like you would any other type of prescription. So I think that it's a different animal, and people have to remember that.
I want to take a call now. Jerry is on Where We Live from Ansonia. Thank you for calling in, Jerry.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Just make sure you turn down your radio. Tell us your comment or question, please.
Yeah, comment. If you have a prescription for the marijuana, could you purchase it from other dispensaries out of state? To the commissioner, I guess, would be able to answer that.
All right. I'll go to the commissioner first, and we also have a pharmacist here.
Well, first, just to clarify, there are no prescriptions here because, as Dr. Salner said, and I think Angelo too, the federal government still considers this a Schedule I controlled substance, meaning they don't recognize any medicinal value. Here, it's a Schedule II, really highly regulated. I mean, Angelo could tell you all the other drugs that are on that level. But it recognizes, which we've been proving through research, anecdotal evidence, Christy told you, the medicinal benefit of it. So there's no prescription. You have to, in this program, you get certified for one of soon to be 22 debilitating conditions. Be six for minors as of October 1. And once you do that, you register with the Department of Consumer Protection, and there's an online process to do that. And you have to actually pick one dispensary in Connecticut. So you can switch dispensaries, but you have to have one that you have. So you cannot go out of state with this. You have to do it in Connecticut.
I'll take another call. Paul is calling from Barkhamsted. Paul, you're on Where We Live.
Yeah, hi, Lucy. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make 2 points. There are a number of my customers, I build and repair guitars, and a number of my customers have type 2 diabetes and necropathy in their feet, and they've tried various medications, and marijuana extracts or however they're ingesting it is the only thing that works for them. The second point I want to make is how the legalization in some states for recreational use has cut the profit margins for a number of Mexican cartels. Esquire this past month has had a great article about how El Chapo's kingdom has been hurt. And what did they do? They started exporting heroin and fentanyl to make up for the money. And that is also leading to the explosion of heroin deaths and fentanyl deaths here in the United States. So it's all intertwined.
Thank you, Paul, for your comment. I want to go back to Dr. Salner. We heard Commissioner Harris talking about how the program is expanding in terms of criteria, dispensaries, growers. As a medical doctor, what conditions do you think should be part of this program?
It's a great question, Lucy, and I think we're really just learning about all the potential beneficial effects of medical cannabis for patients. Clearly, patients who have chronic pain syndromes, particularly those that relate to nerve entrapment, because the cannabinoids link with cannabinoid receptors in the central nervous system, those patients really benefit. So patients with spasms, tremors, Parkinson's, nerve-related pain, and it would stand to reason then, the last caller talked about diabetic neuropathy, it would stand to reason that those patients could potentially benefit because their pain is really related to nerve injury. I think we're really in a learning curve now in terms of which patients could benefit, and we're seeing just in the approved conditions that we're certifying patients for now, that there's even additional benefits to patients that I didn't see when I started the program. So many of my patients, for example, now sleep a lot better than they did before. That wasn't really the reason we started the use of medical cannabis for them. It was really primarily more related to their pain or other symptoms. But I think we'll see over the next year or two, as the total number of patients are served and as pharmacists and physicians understand more about the benefits, and as the program under Commissioner Harris's leadership, you know, evaluates and reevaluates potential candidacy for the program, I think we'll see an expanding list of conditions.
Angelo DeFazio is a pharmacist. Your take on what other conditions should be part of the program?
Well, Dr. Selner brings up a great point. What's really interesting about this is that people don't understand how new the discovery of our cannabinoid system is in our bodies. It was basically discovered in 1988. That's relatively new, thinking of all the years of medicine. And the research going forward is exponential on the disease states and symptoms it can cover, because the CB1 and the CB2 receptors that the cannabinoids affect are throughout our body. CB1 in particular, basically in the brain and the central nervous system, but the CB2 receptors are everywhere throughout our body. So it creates a homeostasis, or what I like to say, a Libra of life, a very balanced Libra of life within your body. So wherever those receptors are, any way we can affect that receptor site can affect a particular symptom or disease state where that organ or that receptor is. So that's why we have 22 different disease states that medical marijuana can help, and that can actually double in the near future. And Connecticut has a great way of adding a disease state simply by applying, having some research. They have a physician review board that actually votes on it. They debate it. They've turned things down before. They debate it, and then they add it if they think it can help patients in Connecticut. So I echo what the commissioner and Dr. Solner are saying. I'd also like to say that I think it's unfair to call our four growers or producers with those words. They are truly pharmaceutical manufacturers. I've been in all four, and the gatekeeping and the science that takes place there and the quality, I prefer to call all our growers pharmaceutical manufacturers, because that's what they truly are.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We're getting a tweet from Aaron. As a man with MS, medical marijuana is still prohibitively expensive for those with financial difficulties and too hard to access. I want to turn back to Christy Cavell again, a Middletown resident. Her husband, Tracy Helene, recently passed away from cancer. This is something that Tracy had was very open about in terms of testifying before a legislative hearing earlier this year. Let's hear a little of that testimony.
I have found the state's medical program is pretty expensive and borderline inaccessible for many people who might have any financial concerns or not live close enough to one of the dispensaries. And I like that this bill would open the program up, and I would really like to see that if there's some way to tie some of the taxes into subsidizing the program for people who can't afford to get on it, because it is, I would say, prohibitively expensive. I've been fortunate over the years, and we saved a lot of money. As my career wound down, I was able to access the program. I'm currently spending $400 to $500 a month on medical marijuana, and I think I heard other people suggest earlier that a fully legalized recreational program might help to lower the price of medical marijuana as well.
So he was testifying about a bill that failed in the last session, which would have legalized the recreational use of marijuana. Did Tracy talk with people who had certain medical conditions that could not afford to participate in this program?
At that particular hearing, he did not. But, you know, through social media and through being so open with his story, he did meet a lot of people and sort of guided them, you know, even in other states to options. So I think because the program is new and, you know, there may be some misconceptions about it, and he was very open about his success, I think we're going to see sort of an evolution of this. You know, and I just want to touch a little bit about the pharmacy itself and the dispensary and the products, which was also featured, you know, in his testimony, and just the purity. And you know, when he would go in and meet with a pharmacist, it was very specific if he was getting oil or a leaf, what it was used for. And, you know, for if it was sleep, if it was pain, he had neuropathy as a result of chemotherapy. So I just sort of want to echo and support with the medical program that, you know, it is very highly professional and it was, you know, very, very beneficial, you know, for him.
Can we talk a little bit about cost again? So we know that Tracy was paying $400 or $500 out of pocket to participate in the medical marijuana program. Obviously, when patients are certified and registered with the state gets a cut. The dispensary gets a cut. The pharmaceutical growers get a cut. I mean, how much are we talking about here? I'll start with you, Commissioner Harris.
How much are we talking about?
And how much money is being paid to for people to participate in this program?
Well, to be a registered patient, you have to be certified every year. And you have to register every year. It's $100 to the state for that. So that is a cost up front. And then we have to have discussions about what happens with that money. Originally, it was put in a fund that would be used to replenish the program so that it was kind of a revolving fund with patients, people with these serious diseases helping each other. Unfortunately, that was put into the general fund. So I have some personal opinions on that. That's a cost, and of course the medicine's a cost. But what people have to remember, again, is – and it's really tough because people need access to the medicine. And we understand that 100%. That's why we have a compassionate need program at the dispensary so people that do have financial hardships have a, you know, a better chance of access. And we're going to review those now that they've been up and running for a little while. I know Angela has a very good one and see if it's effective and see if we can work to make that better. As I said, the market I think will help bring things down. But again, you don't want to take the short-run view and throw out the baby with the bathwater because you have a medical program, this pharmaceutical program, a holistic program that's providing medicine and other consultation on diet, whether it's exercise, Reiki, yoga, all these things that are holistic to keeping people healthy, not to mention what I said, how no pesticides are used, how there are certain, you know, pharmaceutical-grade standards. It's homogenized. It's tested, labeled. You know what you're getting. You're not going to have that in the other system. So this program really should keep on growing, and we need to, on the front end, try to help people as much access as possible. But over time, I think it's going to be much more widely available for people.
I'll turn back to the pharmacist. If Connecticut were to legalize recreational use of marijuana, that those profits could help subsidize to help people who you know, need it for medical conditions.
I echo Commissioner Harris. I was disappointed when the money that's created by the medical marijuana program doesn't stay within the medical marijuana program. I was a little disappointed that it didn't go into the general fund, but I can understand the state's issues with their budget and why the reasoning behind it. And yes, there's no question that the prices have come down dramatically. I mean, if you saw what the prices were initially versus now, the prices have come down, and that free enterprise and free capital system that we have driven some of the prices down. But it's also really important to remember, you know, I also own pharmacies, and some of the copays that you see on a monthly basis, a drug like this would be considered a specialty pharmaceutical or maybe a tier 3 type drug in a particular formulary of insurance. Those copays are $50, $100 at times. So yes, there's some cash outlay by the patients, but in our system that we use insurance for prescriptions, don't think that it's a zero copay. There's hundreds of dollars of copay sometimes associated with products in this type of specialty realm. So yes, but the price is coming down.
I want to thank Angelo DeFazio, owner and founder of Aero Alternative Care and president and CEO of Aero Pharmacy. Thank you so much for coming on. Also on the phone with us was Dr. Andrew Solner from the Hartford Hospital, director of the Hartford Healthcare Cancer Institute. When we come back, we're going to learn about research again on how cannabis could help decrease people's use of opiate painkillers. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about the medical marijuana program here in Connecticut, and now we're shifting to talk about the research behind those who've used medical marijuana. On the phone with us now is Kevin. And Kevin is a PhD candidate, Kevin Banky, rather, a PhD candidate at the University of Michigan. He's also co-author of a recent study on medical marijuana and its impact on opioid drug use. That study was featured in the June issue of the Journal of Pain, also in the current issue of Scientific American. Kevin, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about the research. What did you find?
Yeah, sure. So we were interested in seeing how people with chronic pain responded to using medical cannabis to treat their condition. And we're particularly interested in how their medication use changed, how their medication side effects changed, and how their overall quality of life changed. But our particular interest was, did they change how they used opioids? And so we surveyed folks who patronized a medical cannabis dispensary in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and collected data for about a year and a half. We recruited 185 people into the analyses, and we found that in this population, people had a big increase in their quality of life. They substantially decreased their opioid medication. Of the 118 who were using opioids before cannabis, they said that they decreased their opioid intake by about 64%. And they all had decreased side effects of their medications, as well as they used fewer medication classes. So this suggests that among this population of people with chronic pain, that cannabis seemed to improve their side effect burden and their quality of life, as well as allowed them to substitute something less potentially harmful than their opioid medication.
That's really something. And in terms of research and how the, you know, the federal government views marijuana, I mean, how does that handicap the research that's being done, the other effects on patients that are using it for medical purposes?
Yeah, so I guess to use my study as an example, we chose a study design that ideally we wouldn't use moving forward in the future. So we asked people after they had already been using cannabis how their behavior had changed over the past time. Ideally, we would get people before they started using cannabis and then follow them over time. But because cannabis is a Schedule I substance, which means that by federal law, it has a high risk for abuse and no accepted medical use. It means that there are all of these things in place that prevent us from administering cannabis, or at least that make it very difficult to get a protocol in place that would allow us to administer cannabis ourselves. And it just becomes kind of a logistical quagmire to get involved in that. So when I talked to the senior author on this study about how we would design studies to try to gauge this question, we chose one that would be pretty easy to deal with because it can just be such a hassle to do some of the more clinical studies.
I want to take a call now. Jim is calling from Hartford. Jim, you're on Where We Live.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question, and it's something you guys have been talking about when it comes to the use of opiate pain medications. So the opiate pain medication is a huge problem nationwide, and certainly the underlying problem with opiate pain medication is addiction and addiction sciences. One of your callers made mention of, oh, there are doctors pushing opiates. There are no doctors out there pushing opiates. I'm a physician myself. We don't push anything. We try to respond to patient needs when it comes to pain control. So the underlying issue is addiction and people's responses to these medications that allow them to become physically and psychologically addicted to the medication. So by switching and using cannabis in order to treat people's pain, are we just substituting one addiction for another and not really treating the underlying problem? Or do we even know?
Well, we heard from an earlier doctor, Dr. Solner, who says that it's not addictive. So there's, you know, I guess opinions on both sides.
Well, yeah, and I would honestly in my experience, I've certainly seen some people who can use cannabis recreationally, and I've also seen some people who cannot live without it, and they can't get through a day without smoking or using cannabis. So I'm not sure that that's really as cut and dried as the other physician suggested, and I'd certainly be willing to hear about any research to that effect, but I can't say as I really accept that at face value, and that's just based on having seen hundreds of patients who are habitual users to the point where they can't stop.
Well, thank you, Jim, for your call. We're almost out of time, but I did want to turn back to Commissioner Harris and then back to the researcher. Again, we heard how there's only so much that can be researched in terms of how marijuana is viewed, because it's still illegal here in this country. Commissioner Harris, we've had this medical marijuana program again for more than 2 years. What research is being done in terms of people who are participating here in Connecticut?
Well, first, really quickly, I think the doctor does have a good point about pushing. I don't think doctors are pushing it, but there is overprescribing, and we know that through the PMP. That's one of the problems. Most doctors don't do it, but there's some bad eggs, some maybe unintentional things that happen. Secondly, I think just the recreational piece, this notion of being addicted, I mean, that's the high THC smokers that you're talking about. Again, explained earlier, this product isn't that. And also, whether there might be some addiction, and whether it's what Dr. Salner said or what this doctor said or somewhere in the middle, you don't overdose on it. You do overdose on opioids. So there are a lot of benefits here. It has to be studied. There's been research done in Israel and elsewhere. There's some research that has been done in Connecticut already. But the good news is that as of October 1, we will have a framework for research in Connecticut. And if you are a hospital healthcare facility licensed by the Department of Public Health, a higher education institution, one of the licensed producers or dispensaries, you are going to be able to present the Department of Consumer Protection with me with a program, and we will approve that program if it meets certain standards, and we will license the employees, the participants within that program, and so that we're going to be able to do much more research to supplement the anecdotal information and some of the research already occurring here. One, that will mean that we'll have the evidence that physicians and healthcare providers do need, and I think that's been one of the problems. There hasn't been enough of that. And two, as a secondary benefit, those jobs, the 250 or so plus jobs, not even including the new dispensaries or the labs, we could become, with this framework, the research capital on this type of medicine, supplementing the bio research done in, say, around Yale and New Haven, supplementing Jackson Labs and everything done around UConn. So, you know, Governor Malloy, in getting this program started, and Bill Rubenstein and my predecessor, not only are helping to provide good health care, but also supplementing some of the governor's investments, vision on the biotech bioresearch base here in Connecticut.
I want to turn back to the researcher on the phone again, Kevin Banky, from a PhD candidate at the University of Michigan. This study that's been done is raising eyebrows. What do you hope will happen after this in terms of the work that you're doing, Kevin?
Well, so I hope to ideally continue with some of the more rigorous study designs that I talked about, so following people longitudinally. I think it sounds like what's going on in Connecticut is a really good step to ideally be able to have this institutional support of doing this kind of work, because I think if that's in place, it's much easier for public health scientists, physicians, to actually have open and honest dialogue about cannabis as medicine, instead of going on the one side and saying, oh, it's a panacea, it's good for everything, and on the other side saying, it's poison, we shouldn't use it for anything, it's only something that can be abused.
I want to thank you again, Kevin Banky, PhD candidate at the University of Michigan, co-author of a recent study on medical marijuana, its impact on opioid drug use. That study featured in the June issue of Journal of Pain, also in the current issue of Scientific American. Also, Commissioner Harris, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
He leads the Department of Consumer Protection. And Christy Cavell, thank you for sharing your very personal story. Again, condolences for the loss of Tracy Helene. He was a great guy.
He was. Thank you so much.
I want to thank producers Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. Special thanks to Kion Wolf. This is Where We Live.